This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Mike Kalichman. I'm director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology, also a professor at UC San Diego. I want to welcome you to another program in this year's Ethics Center series framed around Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, Emperor of All Maladies. The Ethics Center seeks, through its programming, to facilitate community dialogue about the ethical challenges that might otherwise impede scientific and technological advances. Importantly, we want the public to hear about exciting new developments, but we also want the scientists and members of the community to work together in identifying the ethical challenges and as well as possible solutions. For this fifth program in our 2013-2014 series, we will focus on the important question of communication among patients, their friends and families, and their caregivers. As we have seen in previous programs, and we'll see with next month's program as well, the technology of cancer care is becoming ever more complex and promising at the same time. We thought it important to include this program along with those programs on science and technology, since inadequate communication can undermine the best of new approaches. It should be acknowledged that the starting point for tonight's program was a recommendation from Drs. Dina Plemons, who I believe is here, and Stanley Malloy, who I don't think I saw tonight, both of San Diego State University, who suggested that we wouldn't want to miss having one of their colleagues in this series, and he is one of our speakers tonight. Before beginning tonight's program, I want to acknowledge the many organizations that have made this series possible. Primary supporters of the overall series include San Diego State University, University of San Diego, UC San Diego, the Moores Cancer Center, Grossmont College, Point Loma Nazarene University, Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, Sharp Healthcare, the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center, and the Legler Benvo Foundation, as well as varying degrees of participation of many other institutions and organizations throughout San Diego. And while many people could be thanked for their help in this series, tonight I want to particularly thank Colette Carson-Royston, who worked extensively with me to help in planning tonight's program. Colette has been in cancer nursing for many years and is a past president of the Oncology Nursing Foundation. She has also served as a member of the steering committee for this year's Emperor of All Maladies series. Colette will be introducing our speakers for this evening's program, but first, please join me in thanking her for her support for this series.
Thank you, Michael. And Michael will be moderating after our two speakers present tonight. I just want to say I'm really excited about our program tonight and the two speakers that I will now introduce. First, I can tell you that both speakers are prolific writers and speakers, well-published and respected, superb teachers and instructors, and I can tell you that because I went online and found how their students rated both of them. But they're both have spent extensive time navigating cancer community. Can I say that on tape? No. Navigating through difficulties with cancer and communication, but they're really from very different backgrounds. Dr. Beach is a local, a professor in the School of Communications at San Diego State. He's spent years of research looking at interaction between doctors and patients and family. Most recently, he has found a very creative way in documenting his findings by producing a staged theatrical production, and we'll be hearing more about that tonight. Dr. Mayer comes to us from Chapel Hill, where she's a professor of the School of Nursing and the Cancer Center at UNC. She's the editor of the Journal of Oncology Nursing and past president of the Oncology Nursing Society. But it's really her years of clinical practice and caring for patients throughout the illness continuum that has given her such a unique ability to understand and feel comfortable in discussing some of our most basic fears and finding a way to express those things. So please welcome our two speakers, Dr. Wayne Beach and Dr. Deborah Mayer. So pleased to have you here this evening. Wayne, you're first. Correct.
Thank you, Colette. Well, I like the way Colette was advancing my slides when she was talking. So since we're on this slide, first I want to thank Mike and his colleagues and their staff for an amazing speaker series and a set of topics. It's wonderful to have communication on the radar with genomics and immunology and DNA sequencing and a variety of other biomedical topics. Of course, you might guess that as a communication researcher, I believe that communication and social relationships are infinitely more complex than any human disease or perhaps even any constellation of human diseases. But that's something we could maybe talk about in our discussion following the talks. Since we're on this slide, I'd like to invite you into three alternative social worlds tonight having to do with communication and cancer. The first is a corpus of audio recordings that have been transcribed of family cancer phone calls donated to me from a family in San Diego. These family phone calls have been also adapted into a professional theatrical production, as Colette mentioned, entitled When Cancer Calls, which has just finished this last month, a national dissemination and effectiveness trial, which we'll talk about. I also want to show you some video clips that have been video recorded from the Moores UCSD Cancer Center, where I do research between cancer patients, family members, doctors, and nurses. Across all these materials, I'd like to raise three primary topics: how are delicate concerns raised and responded to, how is hope socially constructed when managing bad and otherwise challenging news, and how are these materials triggering devices for better understanding and improving communication about cancer. First, the family phone call corpus, 61 phone calls that were recorded and transcribed by a San Diego family donated to me, as I noted. These materials lasted over 13 months from diagnosis through death of a wife, mother, and sister. And these materials represent the first natural history of a family talking through cancer on the telephone in the social and medical sciences. After years of basic research trying to describe the practices and patterns of communication, we're trying to then focus on these materials to address a major problem in contemporary society, communicating about and through cancer. This work eventuated in a book that I wrote entitled A Natural History of Family Cancer, which could best be summarized simply by saying, a family, a phone call, a diagnosis, one family's journey through cancer. You might think of our work as social scientists looking at the detailed organization of human social interaction as the equivalent of having a microscope or other imaging devices. In a sense, we're trying to find the DNA of social life anchored in ordinary conversations, and we're trying to find that genomic order, if I could borrow that from people that literally do works on genomic structures. And so I thought I'd just show you a first excerpt here, which we could literally spend the whole evening talking about, but of course we can't do that. This is drawn from the first phone call between a dad informing the son that the mother's tumor was diagnosed as malignant. Now, this is about 30 seconds into a phone call. You may not know that bad news is routinely delayed, and good news is almost always immediately announced. So this news has been delayed, and this shows just the first moment of how the dad begins to announce and the son begins to respond to bad news. And what I'd like to do is play this clip for you, and then I want to show you immediately how this has been put onto the stage.
What's up? I came back with the needle biopsy results, or at least in part. The tumor that is the adrenal gland tumor tests positive. It is malignant.
Okay. That's the one above her kidney?
Yep.
And here's what it looks like on the stage.
What's up?
They came back with the needle biopsy results, or at least in part. The tumor, that is the adrenal gland tumor, tests positive. It is malignant.
Okay. That's the one above her kidney?
Yeah.
Now, this is at the very outset of a cancer journey and a diagnosis, and I think one of the most difficult calls out of the 61 over 13 months was this phone call between a mother and a son when he speaks with her for the first time about her diagnosis. Throughout the talks tonight, as I noted, I wanted to weave in how it is that we build hope into managing difficult, challenging topics. And the text in the red, in this case, shows how hope on a doctor and seeing the doctor to hear alternative news could be heard as a possibility. So let me play this difficult moment.
It's real.
there's nothing to say. Just I'll wait and talk to Dr. Lehman today. He's the cancer man, and see what he has to say, and just keep going forward. I mean, I might be real lucky if I just might just be 6 months.
Moments later, this phone call continues. What do you do with this kind of thing, radiation chemotherapy? And notice there's another reference to hope.
What do you do with this kind of thing? I mean,
radiation chemotherapy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. My own hope. I mean, my own choice.
Yeah.
Seems better just lay here and let it kill me. And that's not the human condition.
No. I guess so. Not.
And here's what it looks like on the stage.
There's an adenoma type that is worse, but this is very fast, very rapid, very difficult to treat. There's a very small percentage of people that do respond, and we're talking at that maybe 5 years.
Hmm.
So it's real bad.
I guess.
And I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah, I don't know what to say either.
No, there's nothing to say. I'll wait to talk to Dr. Leiden today. He's the cancer man, and see what he has to say, and just keep going forward. I mean, I might be real lucky in 5 years. It might just be 6 months.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Whew!
Yeah.
What do you do with this kind of thing? I mean,
radiation, chemotherapy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. My only hope. I mean, my only choice.
Yeah.
It's either that or just let it lay here and let it kill me. And that's not the human condition.
No, I guess not.
No. So that's all I can tell you, sweetie. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I should think. me too.
Now, not all talk about cancer is difficult, as this outset of delivery of diagnostic news might reveal. I want to show you a kind of a funny clip that we endearingly refer to as Grandma's Underwear, as you will see. But hope also comes out of humor and laughter and telling stories, because you can't talk about cancer all the time. And one primary pattern in these materials is that there's talk about mom and the cancer, there's everyday life on its own merits, and then there's talk about mom as bookends. And so welcome, as we say, to a small excerpt called Grandma's Underwear.
And, I'm taking her in for her GI series the day before Thanksgiving. You know, that means when they give her enemas and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you said you needed a recipe for some cookies.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote some down on a card, and I sent it to you yesterday with some of my sour cream cookies.
Great.
Well, I decided to wrap them up in some soft cloth, you know, the kind you can also dust with.
Well, you know, I don't have a good dust cloth, and I got a couple of nice pieces of nice wood furniture, like that dresser from Aunt Esther, and, you know, those little side tables and all that.
Well, now you can dust with some soft underpants from your grandmother, because I sent them your way.
Well, wouldn't those be just perfect? Give me something to look forward to. And I can explain that to everybody that comes over. You want to see my grandmother's underwear?
Yeah!
So this is not the end of the grandma story. You'd have to see the full When Cancer Calls to close that out. So this is part of the Conversations About Cancer project. And basically what we're trying to do is to integrate the social sciences with the arts to extend our empirical research and explore ordinary family life, and obviously to not take for granted conceptions of cancer, health, and illness. We're trying to increase educational awareness through innovative tools to manage and sustain new insights about communication and cancer, and to create educational materials that are sustainable as health interventions and campaigns. Essentially, materials have been worked on by myself and our team members, that some of which are here tonight, and I want to acknowledge them as well. Started at 2006, and it's just ended a national trial that went through recruitment and added another voices set of voices, about 1,000 people. I've seen it in the national trial in the last several months, and it went to San Diego, Salt Lake City, Lincoln, and Boston. And the audience reactions through at least the pilot data have been really amazingly strong. 91% thought it was an authentic portrayal of a family's cancer journey. 89% thought that it was appropriate for people that watched it and that held it held their interest from beginning to end. 85% thought that it would influence other people if they were to see it. And importantly, especially because the mother dies in this particular context, the 75% approximately of the audience found it uplifting and inspiring, and less than 10% found it too depressing. The factored indices of these on the left broke down to highly significant changes in pre-post measures that we designed from the basic research, as well as you can see from the significance ratios on the right.
It really is conversations about cancer, and what's there and what's not there should generate more conversations. I identified with a lot of what went on in the phone conversations. The actors were outstanding. I really liked the simple set. I think that anybody who was willing to come to this is going to talk more. I just wish that there were a way to get the people who don't want to talk to be exposed to something like this.
I majored in business but minored in theater, and I thought that was just a fantastic production. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people were not acting it, they were living it.
The biggest benefit I see out of what you're doing here is that it opens a subject that we don't know how to talk about. It gives us an opportunity to try and figure out how to talk about this, because it's in everybody's life.
And one more audience member response.
I appreciate it, because I think I'm going to start talking to my children about my cancer. I want them to maybe take this journey with me. And before this play, I didn't want them taking this journey. It was my problem, my issue, and I had to deal with it. And I didn't want to burden anybody else. But this play really changed my feelings on that. So now my children are going to have a say in how the rest of my journey goes. So thank you very, very much.
So a shift then to the clinic really quickly. We've been looking at, in a recent handbook of patient-provider interactions, just came out this year, 50 articles over the last 50 years that are primary studies of communication in the clinic, looking at raising and responding concerns about life, illness, and disease. I just want to show you issues of hope, issues of is stability good or bad news with cancer, and how do worries get addressed really quickly. So one of the things that's amazing about hope is that when you and I as patients bid to doctors for hope about cancer, in the vast majority of instances, those bids are not aligned with by doctors. In this case, a melanoma patient that had been in remission for a year said to the doctor, "So hopefully I caught mine early enough." And the response is, "Well, that's the thing. If you had a 7-millimeter melanoma, the survival is much better if you do a resection early on. And I'd mention to you about the sentinel lymph node biopsy." So this doctor goes textbook or biomedical, and the patient's hope is not responded to with something like, "So hopefully I caught mine early enough." Well, I hope so too, and we're going to work together to ensure that that stays in a good way. And here's another example of how tricky patients can be. When given the floor, never smoked tobacco, one of the things that this patient says, "No, never smoked, never drank, never used drugs, nothing of these bad things." We're finding non-intuitively that cancer patients are working very hard to try to make doctors believe that they're well, not sick. And here's what it looks like.
Never smoked tobacco?
No.
Never smoked, never drank, never used drugs. Nothing of these bad things.
Okay. And are you currently married? Or?
Yes.
So a quick comment on stability. Stable disease is kind of like that vegetable you hate, Brussels sprouts, anyone? You know in your head that it's good for you, but that doesn't make it easier to swallow. Who wouldn't want a clear sign that the cancer is dying, the treatment is working? And this is from an article online called "Congratulations, Your Tumor is Stable." So is that good news or bad news? This is a case where the doctor says, "How are you?" "I don't know. That's what I've come to find out. Your CT looks good, does it? Everything looks fine, nothing's changed," which of course from the doctor is an announcement of good news. But the patient resists and says, "It's not changed, that means it's not getting any better." Well, you know, it hasn't gotten any bigger. It hasn't shrunk down, gone away. But we never expected that. She goes, oh, I did. And he says, well, and nervously laughs. And then she goes, so that means I'm going to have to keep on with this treatment. And so there's resistance and tension often between doctors and patients in the cancer clinic between what counts as good news. And this is the same patient a little later. He says, you sound so perky. I've been so happy because the cancer is under control. And then she says basically that she hoped that there would be an improvement and that the stable is a bit of a disappointment. And it looks like this.
You've always been so perky when you've come in here. And I've been so happy because we've kept the cancer under control and you've had so few side effects.
I guess I got so worked up over it this time, hoping it would be an improvement, you know.
Uh-huh.
And to find that I'm just stable is a bit of a disappointment.
So again, contrast, not changed is good news from the doctor's point of view. Stable is a disappointment for the patient, and those things are constantly being negotiated. If you look at worry, one of the interesting things in the clinic is that when doctors tell cancer patients and family members not to worry, it is heard and treated by them as dismissive. And it's not like we think you have colon cancer, so it's not a major worry at this point. And the response is, yeah, I hope not, you know? Here's another. It's just a really funky number about red cells, different sizes of red cells. Don't worry about it, says the doctor. But the response from the patient is, well, I'm doing good, aren't I? Yeah, it looks great. I hope I stay in remission forever. And you have to admit in everyday life, if you tell people not to worry or don't be stressed, that doesn't automatically mean that they're going to stop worrying and be stressful. Oh, me too. And your white count is good, so you aren't going to get infections and they're all good guys. And that, I think, is a great response from that doctor. I'm going to show you one more, and it's a very skilled researcher and clinician that has an amazing way with patients. And this patient, a leukemia patient, expresses concern that a lymph node in her neck was swollen. I'll show you the video clip. And she says, do you think it's increased in size a little bit? Maybe just a tad, but it's nothing that not something I'm alarmed about. The point I want to make here is that there's a major difference between a doctor telling you don't worry and a doctor saying to the patient, I'm not alarmed about it. And this is how it comes off.
Yeah, it concerns me about the lymph node over here. So you think it's increased in size a little
bit?
Maybe
just a tad, but it's okay. Not something that I'm alarmed about.
Okay.
And basically, it's probably something that can wax and wane
okay.
over time.
Okay.
And I think that I'm just going to register it and
okay.
just take note of it. But you know, the other exam I find is very, very good.
Okay, that's great.
So I'm
that's
very,
great.
Very happy.
In summary, when you look at any discovery science, you come up with non-intuitive findings. One that we found increasingly is that stereotypes about cancer being associated predominantly with death and dying in communication, in the clinic, and in families are simply not true. It's more about the affirmation of life than it is about death and dying. Good news prevails over bad news, and hope predominantly prevails over despair. People show themselves to be amazingly resourceful and resilient. Things like hopes, fears, and uncertainties are not just in the head or in the heart, they're actual social actions that we work out collaboratively. We co-produce them in human interaction. In the clinic, for example, a non-intuitive findings is that compared to how we as patients defer and subordinate to doctors in medical care, predominantly and historically, cancer patients are surprisingly not passive, but surprisingly proactive when trying to convince doctors, for example, that they're well and not sick, when they're trying to bid for reassurance about hope. Doctors often resist patients' bid for hope, and cancer patients often resist good news and hope provided by doctors, for example, with stability and worry, and there's this sense of resistance and tension then built around hope recurrently. I didn't even talk about this finding, but one of the things that came from an earlier study from the National Cancer Institute was that the more doctors try to explain cancer details, the more uncertain patients become, which is, of course, a longer discussion. One of the audience members at Lyceum Theater a year ago in April made the comment in a talkback session of 85 people that voluntarily stayed after When Cancer Calls. And he made a comment that the C in the room is not cancer, it's communication. I have a particular position on that, and you might have something to say as well. And perhaps we can pick it up in the discussion. Thank you very much.
I'm going to tell you the story because my philosophy about this is there's usually questions behind the questions being asked, and that we really need to think about what those are in order to be able to hear what the patient's really asking or the family member's really asking about. So I'm going to tell you a story about somebody who I was involved in his care. He was in his late 40s and early 50s, and he had a metastatic colon cancer. And he had gone to his medical oncologist, his surgical oncologist, and his radiation oncologist to ask how long he had to live. And at that point, all three of them, at different appointments, basically poo-pooed him for asking the questions and basically saying, you're doing fine, don't worry about it, which is obviously not what he was asking about, and that wasn't the answers that were helpful to him. So he asked me if he could meet with me and his wife and sit down. And basically, when we talked about it, I was asking him what he wanted to know, and he wasn't asking, do I have 9 months and 3 days left, which is, I think, the concern a lot of providers have, which is, what if I'm wrong, or what if I get this wrong, or what if I say this? He had young children, and he lived in a bad neighborhood. He wanted to know if he was going to live long enough so they could move out of the neighborhood, or whether he should save his energy and not do that. He had young children and wanted to know how he was going to die so that he could think about whether he could stay at home with hospice or whether he needed to make other arrangements so that they wouldn't be frightened by what was going to happen. Now, I'm not an expert in all these things, but I know cancer enough to be able to say to him, you were diagnosed here and your first cancer came back 3 years later and that was treated, and they did a liver resection and the tumor's gone, and then the next cancer didn't come back for 2 years later. It appears to be relatively slow going. You're responding to treatment. You probably have enough time to sell your house and move. And when he asked about how he would die, nobody can tell that, and he knew that. But I went through what happens when somebody has cancer in their liver and what that death looks like, and when somebody has cancer in their lungs and what that death can look like, and then, of course, all the other scenarios that can play out. So I explained in about five different ways somebody with this kind of cancer, with this kind of spread, what could possibly happen. So they left getting the information they needed, and at the end I'll tell you the story about what actually happened with them. But we all know that cancer is more than a statistic, and nobody knows what's really going to happen. And for you, it's 0 or 100%. And nobody is really asking, can you tell me, am I going to be the 0 or the 100%? What we're trying to do is to get answers to questions that aren't about those numbers. It's about what's behind the numbers. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about how those questions come. But we know that when somebody's told they have cancer, no matter how good the cancer is versus how bad the cancer is, for most people, you stop in your tracks and you get off life as we know it. Life does not continue on, although everybody else around you continues moving forward in whatever way you were doing the day before when you didn't know a phone call could make your life that different. And we're only a phone call away. And I just want to point out about these images, if you've never seen them, Lilly Oncology on Canvas. Lilly does a competition every 2 years for survivors, providers, and caregivers to submit artwork. And they have this competition every 2 years, and then they put out a website that has this artwork, and the pictures are worth 1,000 words as to the story that it's conveying, which is why I like to use this. So many times what happens is somebody will sit you down and say, I have some bad news for you. You have cancer. Now, if you're lucky, somebody does it well, and they're sitting down looking you face to face, eye to eye. That often doesn't happen that way. Many people are actually told over the phone, which I think is an unfortunate way. But then at the end of a long spiel, which is, this is what we're going to do, and this is what's going to happen, somebody will then say, any questions? Like you're supposed to have absorbed any of that after the words, you have cancer. And so what happens with that is, what I did is I put up in here in the word cloud all the questions that come to your mind. Am I going to die from this? what's going to happen to me? Can it be treated? Will it affect me? Will I lose my hair? What will happen with my children, et cetera? And so you can't, at that point, put any of those things into real words in a way. You just say no or shake your head or just are stunned. And it's oftentimes afterwards that some of these questions may come to be clearer in your own mind. And this, you probably can't see it, but if you go on the website, this is nothing but words and questions about the cancer experience, but the bottom line, the artist entitled this No Words, because although all that's going on, it's very hard to put into words the things you're worrying about. Now, a lot of this we talk about at the time of diagnosis, but cancer is a journey, and that is not a bad analogy, because we used to have a war analogy in the 70s, which was terrible, the war on cancer, and there's a reason for that. It had a lot to do with funding. And then we've gotten into, with Lance Armstrong, a lot of issues about, you know, the competitive sportsman stuff, like I'm going to beat this thing, you know, I'm going to win and all of that. And for many people, they may not quote-unquote win, although some may, but there's always a price. Now, I've been an oncology nurse for over 40 years, and I joined the club that nobody wants to belong to about 7 years ago. And so what you find out is during these journeys, people take different paths along the way. And so no two people take the same path necessarily, but there's often these transitions in care. And I counsel women who are ending treatment for breast cancer in my practice. And what happens is during the diagnosis and treatment, people get so focused on getting that part right and showing up for the next appointment and doing the right thing and knowing what your white count is and when's my hair going to grow back and all these other things, that it's not till treatment ends, if you're lucky enough for it to end, that you start asking the questions like, holy smokes, what was that? What just happened to me? And how do I actually integrate that experience with who I am and who I think I'm going to be? And many patients will talk about life BC and life AC, life before cancer and life after cancer. And rarely does life after cancer look the same as life before cancer. Now, I'm as busy as ever. I don't know how that happened, as my life after cancer is life before cancer. But the thing for me, even after working in this area for so long, that's really changed is the fact that I only work with people I like to now. I will not work with people that aren't fun, and I will not work on projects that's a waste of my time. And I will not sit in a committee meeting that has no product or end result around something that's useful. And believe me, the people who sit on committees with me know that. This is another example of what the imagery is, and you'll see this in many of the artwork images that I'm going to show you, that living with a diagnosis of cancer puts you under a cloud that someday you hope to emerge from, but it's rarely a smooth road. There's many bumps along the transitions, and what our job is as health providers, I think, is to help normalize the experience and help people understand that they are where they need to be, and they will figure out how to work with this for themselves with our support as we go through all this, and help them to get out of the other tunnel. Now, I put this slide in here just as a nod to Wayne's work in communication, where there's really a lot of interactions amongst a lot of providers. And I can't diagram sentences like he did, or communication with all the symbolism to represent different things. But this gives you some inkling when you think about the number of providers any one person with cancer comes into being, that there's very difficult to keep track of who the players are or their names and their roles and responsibilities. And they're your team, but it's not always clear who's in charge of the team or what role different people are playing in that team. Now, the National Cancer Institute has done a lot of work on patient-centered communication, and a lot of healthcare professional groups talk about delivering patient-centered care. We often don't get it right. But patient-centered care really focuses on meeting a number of needs. And when people ask questions or seek information, there's many reasons they do that. Some of it may be because it will help them cope with what's going on emotionally. Some of it may be to help manage uncertainty. Is this works for most of the people or not? Like, I've just worked with a colleague who developed a head and neck cancer that's HPV-related. And we're seeing more of that now. Well, the bad news is you have cancer. But the good news is you have HPV cancer, which means in 90% of the people, you're going to be fine. Of course, you have to go through radiation therapy and chemotherapy, by the way. But enabling patient self-management, because most of what happens is not during the visit. It's between the visits. And it's not just you, but it's your family members who are helping you manage. And the fostering healing relationships that may be with your providers, but it may be with your family, it may be with your friends, it may be with your community. And also this information and communication can help you make decisions. Should I have a mastectomy? Should I have a lumpectomy? How am I going to decide if I want to die at home or in the hospital? And so this kind of communication can be really helpful in fostering all of those things. But as this map shows you, it is rarely linear. It is not that straight line transition that I showed you before. And you may or may not be able to read all the words, some of them, life before cancer, life after cancer, perseverance, radiation, fear. It's just full of all kinds of things that you may actually not really feel or start experiencing until it's all over. And then that's when we see a lot of anxiety and depression and even PTSD symptoms in people afterwards, because all of a sudden it hits them what they've been through. And before, they were just getting one foot in front of the other to show up for their next appointment. So what we find then is people that keep searching and searching for the answers to the questions that they haven't been able to formulate out there. They may be asking, how long do I have to live? But the answers aren't about how many days or hours. It may be other things that are beneath the question. Again, this is another image of what happens when people sort of get through their cancer treatment, but it does take a long time to sort of get to the other side of things. And I tell women that I see that the second year after diagnosis, often the year that they're left putting their life back together again in a new way to figure out what that's going to look like. This is called The Road Home, and you can't see all the words in it, but again, it's very similar, which is you end up being scarred or changed in a different way than you were before the experience, and then coming out on the other side, hopefully living your life in a different way. And this is a wonderful quilt idea about when life is sewn back together, it has changed in some fundamental ways. And this is another one that I really like. Because it's one of the things when you become a member of the club that you didn't want to belong to, you don't have to explain yourself or what you're talking about to other people. And talking about humor, there's many ways to make jokes. And because I've had breast cancer and I see women with breast cancer, the things that we can talk about during a visit and the things that I can say to these women I would have never said before my diagnosis. And that when we talk about different things, I can say it because I've been there, which is very different than what I would have said. I might have held back a little bit more and not said it so directly prior to my experience, but now I do it in a different way as a result of that. And this is a young woman who was a student nurse at UNC when she was diagnosed with lung cancer at age 22, and her father, who shaved his head in sympathy with her. And she really talked a lot about figuring out and demanded that we at Lineberger Cancer Center deliver care that they weren't used to delivering, which was more holistic care that was providing support not only to her body and her lung cancer, but to her as an individual. And she almost single-handedly got the state to send funds to the cancer center to be able to develop a support program where we now offer massage and yoga and acupuncture and counseling that weren't available when she was being diagnosed. And this was the first year that Lilly Oncology did the contest, and she and her dad won first place prize for the picture. So it may be familiar to her, but she was actually a student where I teach. So coming back to about the questions that we ask, if you're asking questions to help you manage your uncertainty, they may on the surface look very similar to questions that somebody may ask to figure out how to take care of themselves or somebody who's trying to make a decision. But the question beneath the question may be a little bit different. And we can only hope that your providers are sensitive enough to be able to hear those questions behind the questions. And so what I want to tell you about the patient that I've told you about at the beginning of this, at his funeral many years later, he actually lived for another 3 or 4 years after that, his wife came up to me and said, he died just like you said he would. And I'm thinking, holy smokes, I told her about 5 different ways. I'm not sure what that meant. Well, it turns out that he started to fail to thrive, and he started to get a little bit more symptomatic, but he was able to stay home with his children near him till about 2 days before he died. And when he got a little bit more symptomatic and that it was getting more scary for them, he went into the hospital and died. And what she remembered wasn't that I said he could get hit by a bus or, you know, how all the many different ways that I talked to her. What it was that it helped them prepare. They had moved, they had settled in, and they had been able to plan and make arrangements that worked for them and their family. It wasn't the big question, am I going to die? We are all going to die. It's not about that. It's when and how and under what kinds of circumstances that the questions are really about. And one of the things that I have found very helpful is to help people stand and look at their fears, which get at the questions behind the questions. And I think that that can be very helpful when you're wondering what it is you should be asking. And so I want to end it with the question to you is, what would you want to know? And you often don't know until you're in that situation or circumstances. But again, like the woman said in the film clip, it's going to help me think about it and talk about it more when you're not in the middle of the situation necessarily, to talk to your family like, how much would you want to know? Would you want to know? What would you want to do? What do you think you'd want to do in this circumstance, even though you may not be in it now? And that's not to be morbid, because it can be in the middle of a shopping list conversation or any number of things, although my daughter thinks I'm pretty morbid because I do talk to her about these things, and she just rolls her eyes at me at this point because I have these conversations with her. But I think that we don't talk about these things enough to actually understand what our own fears or concerns are, which would then help us to formulate the questions that we could then bring to our providers and hold them to task to answer them and not to avoid them. And that's my hope for the end of this conversation and for other conversations we're going to have tonight about that. Thank you.
If you're going to find out what you want to know, we're presuming that a lot of what you want to know is going to be from a healthcare practitioner, a doctor, a nurse, somebody on their staff. And the presumption then is that they are going to be able to deliver the information to you that you need. How do they know what you want to know if you don't know what you want to know? I mean, I don't say that at all facetiously, because you don't know what the terrain is. It's new to you. Debbie says, it's your question. Why don't you start first, then we'll see. You
know. That's one of the things that most people, when they're being diagnosed, say is, I don't even know what to ask. So there are actually studies that show that you can actually coach people on question asking that can be very helpful in doing that. And I'll just talk briefly about 2 studies, one by Donna Berry, who actually had an online program to assess symptoms. But not only did they assess symptoms, but then they actually gave coaching language on how to talk to your provider about the problem in a way that would get you heard better. And then there was another recent study that was done called a question problem list, and it was actually done for patients with advanced cancer, and it actually said that many people with cancer have the following questions, and they did not find that it made people anxious or what have you, and they used it as a review list before they went in. They didn't necessarily share the list with their provider, but it helped them shape the discussion for the visit. Now, I'll give you another small anecdote, which has nothing to do with cancer, is my father-in-law, who's in his 80s, was getting a hip replacement, so I created the list of questions for him. Basic ones, like what's my recovery going to look like, what's the risk of infection, some very basic things. And he went and had a second, he went in and saw 3 different surgeons. And the first surgeon looked at the list and put it down and said, I'm going to tell you what I tell all my patients, and then I haven't answered all your questions, we'll come back to it. The second surgeon looked at the piece of paper and put it down and just never even acknowledged the list and just did his thing. The third surgeon looked at it and said, oh, these are good questions. Let's go through it together. Now, you can imagine which person that he picked. Yeah. But I think we have to do our own homework and thinking and talking about what our own questions and concerns are. And there are places to turn to help with that kind of questions, looking at websites that will help with people along different ways, talking to other people who've been there, talking to your family members or what have you. So it's not something innate, but I think there are ways to do that.
Okay, so I think a large part of the key that you've talked about then is to empower the patient to be able to ask the questions in ways that will work.
The other flip side of that, and I'm sure we'll talk about it at some point, is the fact that providers need more training and communication, which is only beginning to be done. There's some excellent programs out there, but most providers who are practicing today have not had communications training on how to do this. So if the clips you saw, one example is the person was standing next to somebody who was sitting on the table to the side of the person. They were at different heights and they weren't looking at each other. That's an example of somebody who hasn't had that kind of experience where the other person was sitting almost at the same level, talking to the person and looking at them. Those are very basic things, but that's not something we are taught in school.
I was hoping that we could give Wayne the chance to fill in that other part, but that's okay. So Wayne, what are you?
I almost forgot what the question was.
Sorry.
That's the problem.
That is the problem. So, I'd mentioned that historically patients, and we're all patients here, tend to defer and subordinate ourselves to medical authorities. So when we go into medical interviews, routine visitations or follow-up specific acute or chronic care or whatever the clinical encounter might be, patients tend to hint and give cues and clues about their feelings, their anxieties, their fears, their hopes, their uncertainties, rather than specifically ask doctors point blank about those issues. And so one of the training points for doctors is to understand that patients aren't going to necessarily be direct. And so to create an environment of trust and to solicit from patients the opportunity to ask direct questions creates a particular type of environment that's not always there when we go into the ivory tower clinic. And so, again, the issue of directness of questions presumes a relationship with your provider that may not be there. And I'll tell you a story of my mother. My mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and prior to this, by the way, I wasn't doing work on cancer, and this got me into doing that many years ago. And she died 4 months later. And she was being treated in, she lived in Iowa, and she was being treated at Rochester Clinic in Minnesota. And I'd heard from many of my doctor friends that I was working in primary care in San Diego, videotaping medical visitations. And the doctors always complained about patients that asked how long they might have to live or how long this disease is going to last or et cetera. And they said, don't ever ask us that because we don't want to strip hope from patients. And so when I called the head oncologist at Mayo Clinic about my mother, I tried something that I think is very effective. And rather than asking how long does my mother have to live, I said, how many patients in the last 5 or 10 years have you worked with that had the same basic symptoms and disease history as my mother? And he paused and he said about 80. And I said, in that population of patients, how long would my mother have to live compared to those other 80 patients? And he paused and he said, about 2.5 months. And she died 2 months and three weeks later. And so what that allowed the doctor to do is to put my mother's prognosis on a bell curve of a sample population and be able to speak from that experience. Had I asked how long does my mother have to live, the direct answer wouldn't have been provided. So I think the most powerful way to train doctors is like we were working today. Show video clips, show transcriptions, show multiple doctors doing the same and different kinds of things. Training doctors and sending them out to try it in the clinic and bringing them back and see how that impacts their ongoing training. If you don't show them videotapes, the worst thing you can say to a doctor, for example, is be empathic. And any doctor will say, well, what the heck is that? about? And if you can't specifically answer it in terms of practices of interaction and communication that are very specific and localized, then it's just too conceptual for them. So I think there's a lot to be said about indirectness and about deference and subordination and doctors' fears to answer too directly because they don't always certainly have a crystal ball that reads the future, just like we don't.
My question is, it wasn't long ago that doctors didn't even tell their patients that they had cancer. And I can remember, my mother-in-law's in the audience here, and I remember when I went to visit her sister, the family said, my wife's cousins, the family said, don't mention to our mother that she has cancer because she doesn't know. That's only 15 years ago. So my question is this. We're here talking about the significance and the importance of communication. How did things change so quickly over the past? I mean, what changed and why? And so that now we're all doctors are talking about, we'll communicate today about cancer, and it's everybody's open about it. So what were the catalysts that made this change?
In the old days, in the 50s on, there was the good patient doctor contract, which is, I'll do what you tell me and you'll make me get better. And that changed in the 70s and 80s. And for me, clinically, there was a seminal paper in New England Journal of Medicine by Barry Kasseleth, where she studied a couple hundred cancer patients about what they wanted to know. And shockingly, they wanted to know their diagnosis, what was going to happen, the good, the bad, the indifferent, et cetera. And there were some age differences, and there were some socioeconomic issues. But that sort of opened up this whole area, which was people do want to talk about it. Now the contrast is I had a patient that was just that scenario where the family was in the hall saying, don't tell my dad. While the oncologist I work with talked to the family about what their concerns were, I went into him and said, why are you in the hospital? And he said, I have cancer, but don't tell my family. So we sort of shortened that game for where the conversation, which was, he does know. So let's now all be in the same room and talk about what this means. So I think there are still instances where those are issues. And people have the right not to know if they choose not to. But, the conversation goes like this. How much do you want to know? Well, don't tell me if I have cancer. Okay, so what do you want to talk about now?
Yep. I think it's now a medical ethical obligation to disclose openly and as accurately as possible and as fairly as possible the underlying conditions and their possible treatments and prognosis. And I think that what's happened is that the ivory tower status of the doctor has been increasingly eroded to the point where lay people can begin to understand that they can demand truthfulness and hope and expect that it would be provided. And so I think that shift occurred over about 20 years, and there were actual malpractice cases that were litigated because doctors specifically would not disclose information. Now, there are many countries. I've had students in Asian countries, for example, where it's clear that the cancer patient does not want to know, and the medical encounter is shaped around visiting the doctor, and everyone knows that the mother doesn't want to know. And that's the patient's choice as well. So I think that is still active in the world culturally at various places. But in America, one litmus test for quality doctor-provided care is can you openly not just announce the bad news, but there's this technique, for example, called a prospective display sequence. Rather than just telling the patient that they have bad news, you ask the patient, what do you think's going on? And the response is going to be helpful for the doctor to be able to calibrate their next response. So if the patient's in denial, you can deal with that. If they're openly blunt about it, you can adjust and deal with that. And so that prospective display practice is something that, again, if it's used regularly, could change the face of medicine. And that way, we're in it together. I think it's back to this notion of partnership and trust rather than this kind of dehumanized, alienated assembly line production notion where you're just a medical record number. And I must make one final comment about oncologists. You know, you're so busy. It's just, you know, as academics we're busy, as nurses we're busy, different professions are busy, but, you know, in 80 minutes people can watch Cancer Call and their lives can begin to be changed. You know, I can spend a year and a half on an article with a collection of instances, 100 instances, find the pattern, publish it, and have 10 minutes on Grand Rounds at 6:30 in the morning on a Friday to 60 doctors that really don't want to hear what you have to say. It's hard to build an infrastructure, hierarchically structured, to be able to really be innovative and to spend the time to learn and to take the time out like we are tonight, which I think is phenomenal.
Yeah, and on that note, I mean, I want to, you know, take a stab at summarizing some of the key points. Our goal here has been to figure out how can we do better? How should we act to be able to make the best of what we have for options for cancer treatment? And it seems to me there are several areas we've highlighted tonight. One is that our physicians are at sometimes, maybe often, falling short of how to appropriately communicate with their patients. So there's something for medical school education, preparing those physicians and other healthcare providers so they can deal better with the patients. There are responsibilities for family and friends, and that's all of us in this room, even if we never have cancer. How do we talk to somebody that comes up to us and says, I have cancer? Even though it seems to be more open in the medical area, the fact is, for the vast majority of people, you say cancer and there's nothing else in the conversation. A wall has gone up and they just think it's the end of the world. And even with the worst of cancers, there are options to try and make your life as well as possible, or turn out as well as possible. Under those circumstances, there are things to be done. So family and friends have a role. And finally, the patients. I think what you've made clear is that we as patients, you know, maybe think about this before someday somebody tells you you have a bad illness. So how will you ask those questions? Who is there who can be with you to help you in that conversation? So these are all things that may seem simple, but these are things that might help improve the quality of care and give us better hope so that we can get, as Wayne mentioned earlier, so we can do better. So I want to thank our audience and speakers for a stimulating evening conversation. So.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.